News.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Available data, however, indicates the Ankole cattle and many other local breeds across East Africa are on the verge of extinction.
That's Catherine Nambi reporting from Kampala about efforts to save local livestock breeds. Details coming up. Also, citizens say Rwanda has closed its border with the DRC due to fears of the Ebola virus. Tension between a Nigerian Shiite Muslim group and authorities grows. And UN Libya envoy Ghassan Salami calls for a truce to be declared in Libya. We'll have these stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, Rwandan citizens say the government has closed the border with the Democratic Republic of Congo due to fears of the Ebola virus. The government, however, denied the border was closed. Early reports today at the border crossing between the cities of Goma and Gisenyi said only people living in Rwanda were permitted across. Several Rwandan traders told VOA today they were denied entry into the DRC. However, the Rwandan Minister of Health, Diane Gashumba, and State Minister of Foreign Affairs for East Africa, Oliver Indungiri, said the border was not closed. They spoke at a news conference a short time ago. Gashumba earlier had told VOA that authorities are urging people not to enter the DRC. The confusion on the border comes the same day health experts in Goma said that the daughter of a man who died of Ebola now has the disease. The DRC has been fighting an Ebola outbreak in its eastern provinces for a year. More than 1,800 people have died of the disease in that time. Tensions between a Nigerian Shiite Muslim group and authorities is growing after a court last week granted permission to label the Islamic Movement of Nigeria, IMN, a terrorist organization. Security forces clashed violently with the group as they took to the streets of Abuja this month to call for the release of their leader, Ibrahim El-Zakzaki, who authorities have held since deadly clashes in 2015, despite a court order for his release. Timothy Obiezu has more from Abuja.
Mimuna Dauda's three children, two daughters and a son, are among more than 350 Shiite Muslims killed in the city of Zaria in December 2015. They were members of the Islamic Movement of Nigeria, or IMN, and had just returned from school when violence broke out between members of the group and the military as they tried to block a military convoy. Dauda remembers the military cracked down hard on the IMN, accusing it of trying to kill the Nigerian army chief. I got a call from my daughter that the military had shot her in the stomach and her sister in the head and set the leader's house where they were hiding on fire. When I called back, I could no longer reach them. They had burned with the building. Days later, authorities arrested IMN leader Ibrahim El-Zakzaki and his wife and have detained them ever since, despite court rulings for their release. Their supporters' sporadic protests and security crackdowns have left many people dead. Abdullahi Musa, a media head with the movement, accuses the government of deliberately trying to eliminate their leader.
This government doesn't want to free Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki. They want him dead. As they try killing him in his house, God did not allow them. Now, they keep him in their custody.
Zakzaki is facing murder charges for the death of a soldier killed in the 2015 clashes. He founded the IMN in the late 1970s, taking after a revolution in Iran. The group now claims to have over 2 million members. Director General of Nigeria's National Orientation Agency, Garba Barry, says their confrontation with authorities is a breach of the law.
They have become like a law unto themselves. In Zaria, where their political spiritual leader used to live, constituted themselves into serious public nuisances. No responsible government can watch when public order is being breached.
Nigeria's police blame the IMN for the recent escalation in violence.
We've seen protesters carry out unprovoked attack on law enforcement officers who are on legitimate national assignment.
A Nigerian court recently granted permission to label the IMN a terrorist organization, further raising tensions with the Shiite sect. The IMN rejected the label, and observers expect further protests, clashes and victims. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja.
UN Libya envoy Ghassan Salami called for a truce in Libya to be declared around August 10th to mark the Muslim Eid al-Adha holiday. He wants it accompanied by confidence-building steps like an exchange of prisoners. The UN envoy said the Libyan warring parties enjoy military support from opposing regional powers who are violating a UN embargo on arms to Libya. VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi spoke with Rhiannon Smith, managing director of Libya Analysis, a consulting firm, about prospects of a temporary ceasefire and a UN silence about the arms embargo violations.
In theory, it is a good idea in the sense that in order for the Libyan conflict to come to an end, for any kind of political or peace process to begin, there needs to be a truce or a ceasefire in place, because it's very difficult to have those kind of political discussions when Libyans are still fighting and killing one another. The idea of having it at Eid al-Adha is a good idea in the sense of it's a Muslim holiday, and having the prisoner exchanges in terms of building that trust between the parties, again, in theory, is a good idea. However, in reality, it's difficult to see how this will work for a number of reasons. One, because the actors on the ground at the moment don't really show any appetite for any kind of ceasefire or truce. The Tripoli militias fighting against the LNA view any kind of ceasefire or truce in the current positions as legitimizing Haftar's move on the city, because this would allow the LNA to solidify their position in southern Tripoli. On the other hand, the LNA view it that if there was a truce, this would allow the Tripoli militias to kind of reinforce and increase the defensive measures within Tripoli, which would prevent them from moving any further. So in short, a truce would mean both parties kind of staying where they are, and neither side is happy with that. And for that reason, it's difficult to see this actually being pulled off in any kind of meaningful way in 10 days' time.
The UN envoy said that Libyan warring parties enjoy military support from opposing regional powers. How do you explain the UN Security Council silence when there are clear violations of a UN arms embargo to Libya?
And I think the reason that the UN Security Council has been unable really to actively condemn any of the fighting or the kind of humanitarian crisis and war crimes that are happening or enforce the arms embargo is because there are so many UN member states who are actively involved in this, and many of the UN Security Council members themselves are divided over the issue of Libya. And therefore, you're seeing the polarization in Libya between the LNA and the GNA aligned forces replicating itself the UN Security Council level, becoming almost a proxy war. And for this reason, the kind of international divides over Libya and other issues are playing out on this. And it means that the UN has been unable to kind of come to any kind of consensus over what to do. And therefore, these violations are going unpunished and undeterred. And that means that they are very likely to continue, unfortunately.
Salama told the UN Security Council that in the course of the current fighting around Tripoli, serious violations of international human rights and humanitarian law by all parties have been committed. Is there a UN mechanism to make responsible parties accountable for such violations?
The UN is tracking a number of these violations. We've had attacks on civilians, medical facilities, a migrant detention centre where over 50 people were killed. There are ongoing violations against migrants in Libya. That's an ongoing issue. You have people who've been previously sanctioned by the UN for either some kind of political sanctions or for involvement in war crimes, and yet these actors are still actively involved now in the fighting. So although the UN does have a mechanism for tracking this, they are unable then to do anything about it. If time and again the UN is kind of issuing statements and saying there have been violations of the arms embargo, there have been war crimes, there have been humanitarian violations, but does nothing stop them, then this just kind of gives a carte blanche to the actors, whether Libyan or international, to continue with their behaviour, knowing that there are no sanctions, nothing to kind of that's going to stop them from continuing that.
So after all, is the UN envoy to Libya still viable?
Salami has been active in Libya. He's still on the ground. He is still meeting with a variety of actors. However, in the longer term, I think the UN support mission in Libya and the UN Security Council have been badly damaged by what is happening in Libya and their failure to act. In order for the Libyan conflict to come to some kind of end and resolution, there needs to be a relatively neutral mediator, and it's difficult to see whether the UN will still be able to play that role, given its ineffectuality further down the line.
That was Rhiannon Smith with Libya Analysis in London. She spoke with VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawy. Sixteen past the hour, you're listening to African News Tonight on the Voice of America. The Zimbabwe government says it will remove some parts of the marriage bill that was introduced a few weeks ago. This comes after a massive public outcry that it could destroy marriage by recognizing cohabitation as a form of relationship. Despite the resistance, the marriage bill seeks to change some practices, including doing away with child marriage. Reporter Kuzaiza Nwashi has more details.
Valentine Maponga is with Veritas, a non-profit organization that reviews laws passed by Parliament and encourages public discussion.
The marriage bill was gazetted on Friday on the 19th of July. The government has always wanted to amend this bill since 1980. It's a step in the right direction in terms of child marriages. It abolishes marriages of boys and girls under the age of 18.
The bill would also make it possible to penalize anyone involved in arranging marriage among children. Critics say the bill has its shortcomings.
Under Clause 40, adult men and adult women who are not married to each other, but who have lived together domestically, will be regarded as partners in this setup. This will be known as civil partnerships.
One section of the bill makes it easy for unmarried partners to share property during dissolution of their relationship. Zimbabwe has a culture of promiscuity, particularly among married men, who sometimes maintain other households apart from their legitimate families. Many married Zimbabweans say this means if an unfaithful spouse dies, all partners in his relationships could claim part of his or her estate. This has sparked public outcry, which resulted in government scrapping Section 40 of the bill. On Wednesday, Foreign Affairs Minister Sibusiso Moyo explained.
Cabinet realized in its own right that Section 40 was being misunderstood and was being misinterpreted, and therefore it was important that it had to be removed, particularly on the part of civil partnerships.
The Attorney General says the bill was meant to give the judicial system the power to decide on property sharing when a relationship ends or one of the partner dies. Maponga says there are things the bill could have gotten right. He points out the age of sexual consent at 16 and marital consent at 18 years of age. He adds that people can still take part in shaping the bill by writing to the Clerk of Parliament, speaking to their legislators, or attending public hearings that will begin soon. For VOA, this is Kudzai Sunawashi from Harare.
Music. Uganda has been selected to host the Eastern Africa Animal Gene Bank, which seeks to preserve the genes of local livestock breeds for future use. The bank is to be shared by countries in the Eastern Horn of Africa and has the capacity to store millions of genetic resources. Catherine Nambi reports from Kampala.
Across the East African community, the Ankole cow from Western Uganda's Ankole region is one of the much cherished of all indigenous cattle. In fact, many prefer calling it long-horned cattle. Emmanuel Kafiti, a livestock farmer in Uganda, explains why he prefers the local Ankole cattle to the exotic breeds.
When you test the meat from Ankole animal, you can easily differentiate it from the one of the exotic breeds. They have what we call fibrous meat, and also their milk. They have a lot of butter fat content compared to other milk from other breeds. So when you are making, you are in a very addition, you make yogurt, a cheese, a ghee, this is the best milk you should use.
Available data, however, indicates the Ankole cattle and many other local breeds across East Africa are on the verge of extinction. Mary Kariuki is from the African Union Inter-Africa Bureau for Animal Resources.
It was predicted that the hardy and graceful Ankole cattle that is raised across much of East and Central Africa was being replaced by black and white Holstein Friesian dairy cows and will disappear within the next 50 years. Definitely a very big disaster for the East African region. It is evident that drought or disease-tolerant attributes have become increasingly important to livestock keepers in the future, given the imminent climate change.
The Food and Agriculture Organization has reported that at least 20% of the world's estimated 7,600 indigenous livestock breeds, among them the Ankole, faced extinction by 2005. This is why an Eastern Africa Regional Livestock Gene Bank has been set up in Uganda to conserve local breeds from selected countries, among them Burundi, Comoros, Djibouti, Eritrea, Ethiopia, Kenya, Somalia, South Sudan, Sudan, Rwanda, and Tanzania. Joyce Kabatsi is Uganda's State Minister for Animal Husbandry.
When we had the attack of ticks, these Frisians and other genetics were so heavily attacked, and we lost a lot of cows. But those who are keeping the Ankole genetics didn't lose as much, because our cows are more used to the ticks, they are stronger, and they were able to fight the diseases. So we are trying to keep these genetics with us in Entebbe for thousands of years. You never know, in future we might turn to them.
Each country will have its own storage room at the gene bank, where animal genes will freely be stored and retrieved at any time. Gene banking is a type of conservation and refers to prolonged cold storage, cryopreservation, that allows virtually indefinite storage of biological material without deterioration over a time scale of at least several thousand years. Siraj Elwaga is a genetic engineer at the Eastern Africa Regional Livestock Gene Bank in Entebbe. He explains how the animal genes will be stored.
We freeze this semen gradually to a temperature of minus 196 using nitrogen, which is being evaporated. Liquid nitrogen is evaporated into a gas. So the pre-cooling starts from there. Then after the semen has been frozen using that system, we pack the semen now. It will remain alive forever.
Animal genetic resources for food and agriculture are essential for Africa's food security and contribute to the livelihoods of millions of people. As such, governments and the international community are working together under the Global Plan of Action for Animal Genetic Resources. It focuses on the need for concerted and collaborative action at the regional and continental levels for the conservation of animal genetic resources. The East African Regional Livestock Gene Bank is one of the six established under the Global Plan of Action to conserve the world's heritage of animal genetic resources for food and agriculture. Other banks exist in Burkina Faso, Botswana, and Cameroon. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
South Africa, over the past weekend, hosted the world's largest marimba and steel pan festival with nearly 2,000 musicians from around Africa, including Botswana, Nigeria, and Zimbabwe. Maurice de Klerk reports from Boksburg, South Africa.
It's marimbas and steel pans galore at the two-day Education Africa International Marimba and Steel Pan Festival, built as the world's largest. The festival, now in its eighth year, mixes traditional African, classical, and even rap music.
As Africans, we encourage our students all to be dancing and singing and playing at the same time, because that's when you get the full benefit of the music.
The festival prides itself in presenting disadvantaged and disabled musicians who compete on an equal footing with other musicians. Marimba teacher at the Dominican School for the Deaf in Hammanskraal, South Africa, Rose Muloy, voices the sign language of one of her students, Boitumelo Lekaka.
I feel very good because people can see that deaf people can do anything, same as the hearing and other people in the world can do anything. Anything, playing marimba, all different kinds of instruments, they can do same as the hearing people and all other people.
Five-time Grammy Ballot Award nominee and American vibraphone artist Jason Malletman Taylor is one of the competition judges.
One of the groups in there was deaf. And that was my first time ever judging a group that was deaf. I'm like, wait, well, how you playing these notes and you can't hear the notes? And I know that was a gift from up above. So if you can't hear it, they probably feel it. And I think it's incredible.
St. Jude's Private Schools of Nigeria is one of the past winners of the trophy for the best steel pan performance at the festival. The leader of the steel pan ensemble, Femi Obadina, says the standard of the competition is extremely high.
This one is actually more competitive because you have, you know, schools, different schools from different countries.
The competition runs alongside 90 music workshops. Award-winning composer and steel pan player Dave Reynolds feels marimba and steel pan music is like therapy.
It's very emotionally engaging. There's a small amount of technical and musical knowledge that they use, but a lot of it is just coming from the heart.
This year, the youngest percussionists received the biggest trophies. Jason Taylor announced some of the chocolate awards for the best player in each performance.
You got it going on. Participation, smiling, happy. You get the chocolate, 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 chocolate.
Botswana's Acacia Primary School was awarded the best steel pan performance. While Zimbabwe's St. Martin's Convent Primary School was honored for the best marimba performance. Marisa de Klerk for BOA News, Boksburg, South Africa.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington on behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our engineer, Patrick Deya. Thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our 5-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Stand up!